What's Your Story? Hosted by Todd Phillips. With special guest, Scott Christian Saba. What's Your Story? Is a Togo Tunes Entertainment production.
We are back with yet another episode of What's Your Story, and I think you're going to like this next guest. What a crazy last few months it's been, you know? I mean, since the last episode, right? Crazy. You know, I don't even want to get into it other than just to say that I'm just thankful, and I'm just happy that you're all here to join me, to even take an interest in this podcast. I just do it because it just feels good in the heart. It feels good for me to do these interviews. Maybe it's selfish because I feel better than perhaps the guests do afterward. But and hopefully you enjoy it. That really is what it comes down to. I mean, there's nothing better than to know that maybe somebody here listening can benefit from either some words of inspiration, motivation, tips or lessons from past experiences from pros that are on here and newcomers alike that are on here, and they're talking about their challenges and how they've gotten around them or how they're working through them. It all just adds up, and it's like paying it forward. And if this is just my little part of contributing to that, then so be it. I will take that responsibility with great pride. And enough of that. You didn't come here to listen to me ramble, so let's get on with the show. Today's special guest, Scott Saba, has donned many creative hats throughout his illustrious career. Producer, writer, animator, illustrator, and director, just to name a few. And this doesn't even cover the fedoras he likes to wear as part of his daily wardrobe. If you've ever followed his wonderfully crafted books and webcomic, The Dreamland Chronicles, then you know the genius behind his mind. More recently, that talent hit the big screen with the 2020 Netflix release of the CGI hit Animal Crackers, in which he wrote, co-directed, and co-produced. Join me today as we discover firsthand what it truly means to face challenges, adversity, and setbacks head-on with a fierce determination and belief in oneself. He's got a lot to share, and he does so with the generosity and honesty he is truly noted for. So hopefully you can stick around for the next hour as we chat one-on-one with Scott Saba, next.
What is it?
It's circus fun right in your bowl, and you're gonna wanna come flying. For horses and hoops, balls and bears, elephants and lions.
Huh?
Horses, hoops, balls, bears, elephants and lions. New circus fun cereal. Crunchy red hoops, speckled balls, and many marshmallow animals. Circus fun, a spectacular part of this complete breakfast. New circus fun cereal.
It's here! Snow Kaboom Vitamin Cereal! Even the candy stars are vitamin charged! You need Kaboom! But I love Kaboom Sugar Sweet Fruit Flavor! It's a ball! Get new Kaboom with vitamin charged stars!
Welcome back. Let's get straight to the interview. And what's your story? Scott, welcome to the podcast today. And hopefully everything is going well for you and your family so far in 2021.
So far, so good.
Great. Yeah, it's. I'm hoping 2020 is like way behind now, behind us. And you know, I'm like, God. One thing I always love to touch on here is like going back to their youth, because you know, you're a guy with many talents, of course, ranging from artist, writer, producer. We can go on, and you're a director, and you've got all these other skill sets in the creative within the creative community. But I'd like to, you know, hear a little bit more about your childhood. If you could tell us where it all started in regards to your your younger years where you were brought up, and also when you discovered your love for the creative arts.
Yeah, I was born in Yonkers, New York, 1968. So it was a while ago, and my mom was a fashion illustrator. Her brother, my uncle Ray, was an illustrator for the New York Society of Illustrators, or a member of the New York Society of Illustrators, and then their uncle Dave was an artist as well. So for me, it was always something that was in the family. We moved to Florida when I was four, and I was there. That's where I remember my childhood was being in Florida, Miramar, Florida, until I was 12. And then we moved to San Jose, California, where I went to junior high and high school, and then eventually college. And but yeah, for me, since I was maybe... from probably the time that we moved to Florida, since I was about four or five, I started drawing, and I just never looked back. And I fell in love with the Spider-Man animated series, the old Spider-Man.
Yeah,
So that was what I fell in love with. And then so my mom started picking me up, the comic books, and I would copy them. And that's all I wanted to do was be the artist on Spider-Man. And that just started my lifelong affair with comics and Spider-Man.
Excellent. That's excellent. Yeah, well, I was born in 64, so I know all about that. Yeah. So, and that's another thing. I won't get into it here so much, but I think a lot of people have this thing about copying and stuff. But I found that's kind of how I learned to draw, was just copying the stuff I liked. How you... I don't know. And then you kind of start maybe creating some of your own characters. I mean, I did it as a kid and kept showing them mom and dad, look, Amazing Man, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. There's nothing original. Nothing is original. And the sooner you learn that, the sooner your life is going to be better. There's no original songs. There's no original movies. There's no original stories. There's no original paintings. Everything is influenced and based off of your experiences, which are based off of someone else's work. And and I think once you understand that and you accept that, I think you can let go. And I over the years I've copied the styles of so many different artists because I admired it. I liked it. I wanted to. It's like you're consuming it, you're absorbing it.
Right.
And you're bringing it into your own. But you're not that artist. So if I loved Norman Rockwell, I could copy it as much as I want to, but I'm never going to be Norman Rockwell. There's always going to be something else that influenced me, something in my past that is going to make my illustrations a little bit different.
Exactly.
And it works for everything. It works for writing and books and movies and everything. So I think people need to get past the copying thing, except that nothing you do is original. Absolutely nothing you ever do will be original. It's an original take on something that influenced you, but it is not original in the fact that you did not come up with that.
Yeah, and it's so crazy that sometimes you don't even, like, somebody else looking at your work will see influences that you might not even realize, and then they bring it up and you're thinking, oh my God, I watched a lot of that as a kid, or I read those books as a kid. God, there must be something to it. Maybe there is some of that in my style, whatever that is, because I love Hanna-Barbera. That's what I grew up with. But I understand, limited in animation, and people criticize that work, but I'm like, it was a part of my life. And so some of it leaks through. I'm noticing my sketches. I'm like, wow, I guess it's just a part of the fabric of my life, coming out.
I still find it odd when people say that they saw my work out in the wild and they instantly were able to spot it. They say, I know your style. Like, I don't have a style.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I can say, all I see is me fumbling my way to try to make something presentable. Yeah. But somehow people can see a style.
You do. You definitely have a style, but at the same token, I have to give you a lot of credit because you also have It's like I'm looking at some of your stuff. I've looked at it in the past, some of the work you've done just with the brush pen work on Instagram, right?
Yeah.
It's incredible because it's like a whole different side of you that, you know, it's like, wow, I think of you as a lot of the, a lot of your style with the CGI and 3D kind of a look and feel.
Yeah.
And then here you are doing this stuff on Instagram. I'm like, are you kidding me? Look at this guy. He's like, I'm like,
I think I go through different decades. You know, I like in the 80s and 90s, I was doing colored pencils. Then in the early 2000s, I was doing all CGI. And then I took up watercolor and then gouache painting. And then now I'm doing watercolor and ink. And it's just, I'm thinking, God, it'd be nice to try sculpting one day. And yeah. And that's why I feel like I look at artists who have developed a style over the years and they've stuck to it. You know, comic book artists, painters who've developed this unique thing and they stick with the same medium and the same subject matter. You know, whether it's like a J.C. Leyendecker, or it could be a Gil Elvgren who does the pinups or did the pinups, you know, somebody who's recognized for that one thing. And I'm not. Right. I keep changing. Like when I did the Star Trek covers or Mortal Kombat, it was all in colored pencils. When I did Spider-Man, it was in CGI. I keep changing because I keep getting attracted to this style or that medium or whatever. And so I think I don't want to use the word legacy, but my identity has suffered for that because I'm all over the place. I mean, you know, like they say, jack of all trades, master of none. That's me. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I think you're master of many trades, dude.
Thank you.
Very nice stuff. And so somebody backed you into a corner and said, okay, Scott, I want you to create this picture of a bear, and I want you've got to do it now. What would be your go-to style? Where would you, or is it going to be a matter of just where you're at that moment?
It's where I'm at that moment. Like you asked me 2 years ago, it would have been in gouache.
Okay.
And if you ask me now, it would be pen and ink and watercolor, because I'm doing two or three of those paintings a day. And I just, that's just where I am right now. I still miss gouache, and every once in a while I kind of want to dabble with it, but I'm kind of hitting a groove and I want to see where it goes with the watercolor and ink. And I'm just filling up sketchbooks and doing portraits of people and whatnot. But, like if I had to do a movie poster, I'd go back to gouache.
Yeah.
And, so I think it also depends on what you're drawing.
Cool. Very cool. Very nice. Yeah. Oh, good. I mean, watercolor scares the daylights out of me. I just feel like there's no control. I'm like, how do
there
I?
Isn't. There isn't. But that's where the ink comes in. I think the ink gives me that feeling of I can get in all the hair, I can get all the little details that I want to, and then let the watercolor run wherever it wants to go. And I think it's kind of a peanut butter and chocolate kind of thing, you know. they kind of go together in that way that just makes it work, because and I've been trying to let the watercolor just, like, you know, just big blotches on these pretty women that I'm drawing. I'm gonna just let it, just big blotches of just dried watercolor that just sits on their face, and I'm just going, I'm gonna be okay with that. I'm gonna let the watercolor be what it is. And I could, my inclination is to smooth it out and to make the skin nice and smooth, but right. I'm just trying to let the watercolor be watercolor and see where it takes me. But watercolor is, I don't find it more difficult than something like oil or acrylics. That feels like you're working with mud. I definitely, it has a life of its own. And especially with like a cold press, very toothy paper, it's just going to go wherever the paper leads it. And it's kind of an adventure.
It's not, I'm going to revisit it, because I do love, there's nothing more, to me, I love the look. When somebody does it, like you said, when you have the watercolor free flowing, and then you've got then you got all the crispness contrast of the ink.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing. It's almost like, for me, I guess, you have to let it go. Like you said, you just have to make a decision. Let it go. Let the watercolor do its thing. It's almost like a yoga of the creative arts. You know, it's like
a Zen kind of thing.
Yeah, just let it go. And then you can go back in and do your, you know, your detail stuff that you just love to do with the ink, you know, and just, I might have to revisit it again because I could use some stress relieving stuff right now.
That's kind of funny because you're like, you can't control it. You can't control it. I'm going to try that for stress relief. That doesn't sound like those two work together.
Yeah.
But I'm give it a shot.
You're talking me into it. I'm going to have to try this.
Like, okay.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Yeah. It's, you know what? It's every time I put, you know, watercolor to paper, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't. And, and that's both exciting and scary at the same time.
That's funny. Yeah. So as far as your education then, where did you go to school, or, you know, what secondary art training did you have? And also, did you feel like it was worth it? I mean, was it a good experience?
I went to the Academy of Art in San Francisco. My family, we lived in San Jose at the time. And, so it was just a train ride, out into the city. But, I was an illustration major, so I was going to kind of, I was majoring in the same thing my uncle, had majored in, and, made a career of it. But honestly, I graduated in 1991. By 1990, my junior year, I had gotten an internship at Sega of America, and that introduced me into, animation and working in games. And I was just looking and saying, really, no one was hiring because Photoshop had come out, and suddenly no one was hiring illustrators anymore. And so I in a lot of ways, I got into a career that was dying. And fortunately, I got an internship at Sega, and I kind of pivoted into video games. But I love illustration. I don't know if I would have been able to make a living, you know, like, I just don't know if I would have had the temperament to paint every day for a career, you know, working with clients and whatnot. So I think being able to do it for myself has been better. But, you know, it was a good education. We did a lot of figure drawing. And so it was like 3 hours of figure drawing a day. And so it was a lot of drawing. And I think that definitely helped just build up my skills and my confidence in being able to draw.
No doubt. Figure drawing, my goodness, that's so valuable. I mean, if you can get down the human anatomy and get that, you know, mastered, and figure drawing as well, you know, gesture drawing and all that, and then that's your core. I mean, you know, I still struggle with legs and arm, you know, and I'll be like, how could I not get this right? You know, like, what? excellent. That's excellent. So, oh, that reminds me, because I've got a little side note here. And is this true or false? You can kind of give me some clarity on this, or confirm either way. But 1984, speaking of video games, there was a video game called Paperboy that came out by Atari. You're laughing already. Were you like the model? You were for the character?
I did a little video about it on TikTok. My dad, when we were living in Miramar, Florida, my dad was working for Midway, which did pinball machines, and he was a mechanical engineer, and he got a job offer to come work at Atari in the coin-op division. And so we moved there, 1981, somewhere around there. And, you know, your dad works at Atari. This was at the peak time that Atari 2600 came out, and they were the biggest thing in the world. And my dad wasn't working in that division. He was working in the arcade division, but any chance I could, can I go to work with you, Dad? Can I go to work with you, Dad? And so every once in a while I get to go to work, and I would just hang out all day eating junk food and playing video games in the arcade. And it was just every kid's dream. And I was just there so much that the guys there just decided to put me to work. And they told my dad, you know, hey, when your son comes back next time, bring his bike. You know, we want to video him for reference for a game that we're working on. And my dad wasn't working on that game. It was just another division or another group of, because they were usually doing like five different video games at a time. And my dad was was mechanical anyhow. So he was working on flippers or bumpers or whatever they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I came in one day and I used to wear my hat backwards and I had this, this red jacket that I would always wear, you know, from my soccer league or whatever. And they had me jumping over ramps and tossing, it wasn't newspapers, but it was just tossing something, you know, and whatever else that they would have me do. And then I forgot about it. Cause it was just, hey, I got to ride my bike around Atari for a little bit and then go back to playing video games.
Oh my God.
And it wasn't until I was in high school, and I was at, the local grocery store was like a 7-Eleven. It was called Little Grocer. And me and my friend walked in and I saw it and I went, wait a second, that's me, you know? And I got to talk to the, cause I wound up working at Atari, in 92, I think it was 91 or 92. And so I got to talk to some of the people and I got to at least confirm my, you know, like that was me, wasn't it? Oh yeah. We remember, you know, yeah, cause you know, it was only, you know, like eight years ago. So some of the guys were still there. And,
yeah.
So that was kind of cool, but yeah, it was kind of weird just to, I would think that that's probably what models or actors must feel like, you know, with, you know, they do something and then they forget about it. Then they see it on a commercial or something later on. Oh my God, that's me. You know?
But yeah. Video that's game. That is the coolest Paperboy. Story. I love that.
Yeah,
that is so cool. Well, think about it, the early days of Disney with all the rotoscoping. And I've heard some stories that, I mean, they wouldn't even be politically correct now. I mean, to even, you know, talk about it. But some of the, but if everybody got paid and compensated, but they'd bring in for even like some of their animal characters, they brought in people just to get that.
Yeah.
You know, it's incredible. You're like, wow. But. So anyway, well, before I leapfrog over to, you know, because we're probably going to cover animal crackers. Speaking of animals, see that little segue in there. We cannot talk to Scott Sava without mentioning another one of your masterpieces in the graphic novel online comic world, and that's Dreamland Chronicles. I mean, we gotta cover that. And for those two people in the universe that have not had the pleasure of enjoying this, or are not aware of it, of the Dreamland Chronicles. I was wondering if you could just share with us a little bit about, you know, your elevator pitch about what the story is about, and what really inspired you to start writing it back in 2003. Hopefully I've got that right.
Yeah. When my boys are born. I had the idea started in college, when I was taking a history of illustration class. And we happened upon one of the days was talking about Winsor McCay and Little Nemo in Slumberland. And for anybody who doesn't know that, but it was a turn of the century, 1908, you know, to 1920 maybe type of comic strip. It was a Sunday comic strip. And at the bottom of every comic strip, so it was about a little boy named Nemo who would go to Slumberland and have adventures with the Princess of Slumberland. And at the bottom of every comic strip, he would wake up. And so if in the comic strip he was falling, you know, out of the sky, he would wake up, you know, out of his bed because he fell out of bed. Or if he was dreaming that he was drowning, it was because his mom was splashing water on him to wake him up, kind of thing. And it was very, very popular. They had plays and merchandise and everything. It was very popular. And the idea was just what happened when he grew up, because he was like maybe 8 or 9 years old. And so there was really no romantic ties, but I was just wondering if when he grew up, did he still go back to Slumberland and did he fall in love with the princess? And that's where the Dreamland Chronicles kind of came about, was actually Alexander's the main character of the Dreamland Chronicles. He was originally named Nemo. So I was kind of writing essentially a sequel to Little Nemo in Slumberland. But in 2003, we had our twin boys, and I wanted to write the story for them. And so I named Alexander after my son Logan's middle name. And then I just made them twins, because in my story, there was the next door neighbor. I just made them twins. And so Daniel is named after my son Brendan. That's his middle name. And and it's a story essentially about a young man who goes back to the dreamland at night, which is where he and all other kids go when they sleep. And it's this magical world that kids go to when they fall asleep. And there's dragons and elves and dwarves and the Kinchin Sink, you know, everything. I've got King Arthur and and everything in there. And I loved it. And it was just what was wonderful about it was, as my boys were growing up, because they're 18 in a couple weeks. Wow. So as they were growing up, they would get interested in stuff like, you know, Native American stuff or King Arthur or Egyptians or Gilgamesh. And, you know, and so as they were studying stuff or whatever, I would add that into the story and I would fold it into the story. And so the centaurs are you know, essentially, the, you know, they worked with the Native Americans. And I got King Arthur and Merlin and Excalibur in there. And I mean, there's just so much fun stuff that I love too. And so the story really, really kind of grew. And over 13, 14 years, I would put a page a day up on the website, the Dreamland Chronicles. And it became 8 books, and we've got toys and kids come dressed up in costume when I go to conventions. And it was just amazing. It was an amazing journey. And it's my favorite story. That's the... You know, before I die, I want to do a series. I want to do an animated series of the Dreamland Chronicles. I think that would just be so fun to do.
That would be cool. That would. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. Your first iteration of it was in the CGI kind of 3D style, and I know you were utilizing and leveraging what was available then. You know, the most that you could get out of it, and it's beautiful work. And now I've noticed that you. And for those that maybe do know of the Dreamland Chronicles but have not revisited, you know, the site or anything back, you have relaunched it in the more traditional 2D style.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about what went on behind that decision. And by the way, that's also beautiful work by Tracy Bailey, correct?
Yeah. What had happened was I got to fulfill my childhood dream of doing Spider-Man back in 2002. But the only way I was trying to do it painted, trying to do it drawn, couldn't get Marvel to notice me. It was actually Marv Wolfman, who created Blade and the Teen Titans, who told me, why don't you try taking your day job of animation and putting it into comic books. And that's how I got the gig. So when I got Spider-Man, I was really kind of learning on the fly. And when I finished up the series, I wanted to push it. I wanted to see if I could make it cinematic. And that's where I really tried to apply all of that to the Dreamland Chronicles. And I invested maybe a couple $100,000 over the years into hiring character designers, environment designers, modelers, all the software, everything I could over the years to build that stuff out, to make it more like a movie production. But like you said, I was really pushing the technology, especially public, you know, over the counter, we'll say, technology. And this was, again, it was 2003.
Right.
You'll see the quality improve over the years. But what happens when I got to the 8th and final book, I was, you know, 2000 pages in, I was 10, you know, I was, 10 years. So it was 2013. Actually it was more than that. I'm sorry. It was 2014, because I was starting Animal Crackers. The software just couldn't handle the old rigging, the old models, the old, you know, the software had advanced. It had been over a decade. The software had advanced so much that I couldn't open up the old files. And on top of that, I was starting Animal Crackers, starting a movie. Yep. So rather than just stopping after getting to the 10-yard line, I decided, I asked Tracy Bailey to try it. And I had to do some coaxing because I had met her because she was a fan of the Dreamland Chronicles and she had done some fan art. And I had to convince her that she could do it. And so for those last two chapters, those last 300 plus pages, I would storyboard it out so that way the storytelling was similar. But I think about halfway through, I said, you know, you can take it from here. You don't need me to storyboard it, because I was my style was very limited. I wanted her to kind of take it in her own direction. I still, you know, I gave her the script. But yeah, I saw what she was capable of doing, which I couldn't do with the CGI. And I said, the story really needs, it needs to breathe a little more. The CGI was very stiff in places. And again, it's not that the technology isn't there now, because I mean, you can see what you see in movies.
You can
do beautiful stuff, but to do that, you know, as a single person on your own, without, you know, $100 million or something, is just, you're really doing yourself a disservice. Whereas Tracy, just on her own, can bring that life to a scene. She can bring those expressions and everything. And all I do is all I had to do was just write the last book, which she did an amazing job, and she really brought it to a wonderful end. And then I just said, why don't we start over? And I started up a little Kickstarter, and I'm hoping once I get the next movie going that I can just pay her a full, because she's only doing 2 pages a week. At that rate, I mean, it took me 13 years, we'll say, to do Animal, or to do the Dreamland Chronicles at 5 days a week. So I was like, I need to get you full time so you can really, because I don't want her to be 80 years old and finishing up this year. So I wanna, you know, just let's get this done. There's 2,000 pages she's got to do, and she's done the first, she's on chapter 4 of 22 chapters.
Wow.
So she's got a ways to go, but you can see just if you look at the last pages of the last book that she did back in 2014, 2015, 2016, compared to the pages she's doing now, she's really developing into a style. She's really adding, it's so beautiful. The stuff that she's putting out is just really, really nice. And so I really think that by the time she gets to the end of the series, she might want to redo those original pages that she did back in 2014, yeah. 2015, you know, but that's art, you know, that's what, right. But I'm really happy with it. And I really think the Dreamland Chronicles, I had a wonderful audience online, but I could not get publishers to pick it up because it was CGI. There's just a bias against it. Whereas I really feel that now with Tracy's art, I think publishers are going to be a little bit more open to the story, and I could get it out to a wider audience from a publishing point of view. I mean, we had 34 million people, you know, come to the site, but there's just that, hey, if you can get a Scholastic or a Random House or somebody to pick it up and get it to a, you know, wider audience, that's still something I'd like to see.
Oh yeah. I really believe that will happen. And I also believe at some point it's going to make either the big screen or, you know, become like an animated series. I can see it. You can just see it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really happy with the story. I mean, it really just, everything just tied in so well, and it was just, there's so much love that I put into that story. So much love. I'm happy with it. It's just one that I'm just so happy with it.
Yeah, well, rightfully so. You should be really, I'm proud of that. That's and 2,000 pages. I don't even want to. I can't even imagine. I'm not even going to think about it. It makes me nervous. But like, wow, and 5 days a week. Whew. But well, speaking of now, I've got to ask this question because I'm a bit of a fan of the Thing from, you know, Marvel's character, Fantastic Four, the Thing, and of course that means obviously I fell in love with, you know, Paddington, Rumblebottom, the Third. Where did that name come from? Come on.
Well, Paddington Rumblebottom the Third. I was having a hard time with that, and so I had. Pulled out, my wife and I, we had, I think in 2000, we had gone to, for the first time ever, we'd gone to London and Paris. We took like a tour. And so we had a map. And I came across Paddington Station. And I had already come up with Rumblebottom. So it was just a matter of just putting two names together. And Paddington Rumblebottom just kind of flowed. But I had to add the Third. To the end. So yeah, it was named after Paddington Station.
That's hilarious. Fantastic. Really cool.
and yeah, he is an amalgamation of Ben Grimm and the Rock Biter from The NeverEnding Story.
How cool is that? That's sweet. And as we're talking, I'm looking, I've got a little poster to the right of me here of The Thing. So that's cool.
Yeah. Oh, nice. Yeah.
Unfortunately, I cannot afford the original, issue number one of Fantastic Four. I mean, that would be cool.
Oh, my God. Yeah. But I have a wonderful sculpt of Ben Grimm right, on my desk.
You were talking about earlier getting into sculpting, and I think you should.
Yeah.
I see some Dreamland characters, Chronicle characters coming out, or even some of the Animal Crackers characters would be really cool. Just saying.
Fun. Yeah.
Now, I know you did mention the four-part miniseries you did with Marvel, Spider-Man 2002, Quality of Life, right? That was.
Yeah.
Now, would you ever be interested in doing something like that again with Spider-Man? And if so, would you use the, would you do it in that 3D style, or would you go a different way?
Funny enough, I think I'd say no. I kind of got it out of my system.
Really?
And I have friends who want to just spend their whole lives making Marvel, comics for Marvel. Like, that would be their dream. And I did it. And it was kind of like an itch I had to scratch, and now I'm good. I wouldn't want to illustrate it. I think for me, now that I'm doing animation, like direct, I think I would like to write. I'm really enjoying writing, but I would want to write a series or a movie or something like that. I think and probably not Spider-Man. Like I spent my entire life, chasing Spider-Man. I think, I would want to, do something, like Superman or Batman or something like that, try something different. But sure. Honestly, I like my own stories. I think I love the freedom of creating my own stories and not being bound to a corporation's, limitations.
Yeah. That makes perfect sense. I see that. I can totally relate to that.
Yeah.
Now, in 2007, I'm not sure if a lot of people are aware of this. Could be. I really wasn't, to be honest. But you did a little animated short called The Emperor with Mike Kunkel.
Yeah.
And of Hero Bear and the Kid fame. And I love his work in that comic book. Was that a fun experience? I mean,
it was amazing. Yeah. It was a pilot for a series. Mike and I, we were partners for, I would say about 3 or 4 years, at that point. We were working together on several things. And what had happened was we had originally done a pilot for Disney called The Zoo. And, nothing really happened with it. But one of the guys from there, I think, went over to Nickelodeon and they kind of like, hey, can you pitch this again? But we, couldn't because we got paid by Disney. So we came up with Emperor. So it was kind of a very similar kind of thing. But we just had fun working. Mike had some crazy designs, as he always does. He designed all the characters. We co-wrote it together. I did most of the animation and we were trying out some styles of seeing if we can make the backgrounds look like textured with watercolors. And we just tried different stuff. We were just really and we got to meet actors like Kevin Michael Richardson, who plays the Lion. And it was a really fun experience. And unfortunately, it did really well. It tested really well and it was moving forward. And then Viacom bought DreamWorks, who own Nickelodeon or something like that. And then it became, Viacom bought DreamWorks, but Viacom also owned Nickelodeon. And so then suddenly the Madagascar Penguins, took precedence. Well, we can't have two penguin shows. So we
got
home. It's fine. But I still remember Mike and I, because it was both of our brainchild, and we were always so close, and we were always so nice that it was kind of like a don't know if it was, no, Chip and Dale don't talk, do they? Or was it, what was the two?
Yeah, they did. I think they did. Yeah.
What was the two chipmunks in the Looney Tunes that was like, oh, no, after you. No, I insist. No, you go first. Like, yeah, that kind of thing. You remember? So that was us. You know, it was like, well, you should put your name first as director. No, you did all this. No, you should. So we flipped a coin and I won. So it was just, you know, because it was like, we should go alphabetical. No, but you did. Yeah. You know, so it was funny. But yeah, that was a wonderful experience. Really, really cool. Fun.
Well, as soon as I saw it, I go, man, he worked with Mike. That's so cool.
Yeah.
And I had a very, like, a side story. I had purchased a couple of his comic books, The Hero, Bear, and the Kid, and I thought, oh, this is really cool. He did, like, the very loose, sketchy style. It was really refreshing at the time, you know, and I'm like, yeah. And then I had this, he had, like, this lithograph, and he signed it, and I thought, oh, this is great. I had it in my son's room and stuff, and when he was growing up, and then there was a rumor that Hero Bear and the Kid was going to be a movie release.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, yeah, baby, this is great, you know? And then all of a sudden I hear, oh, it was dropped for Curious George. You know, I'm like, what? I'm like, oh, man.
Yeah, it was going to be a cute movie. I was working on it with him, and he had a bungalow at Universal Studios, and I would go visit him, and he has a little cart, and he was just, you know, he was living the high life, you know. It was just, oh my God, I can't believe you got, you know, you're making a movie, and and it was so cool. And but yeah, I think he was adamant that it was going to be traditionally animated, and this was at the time when everybody was going CGI. I mean, traditionally animated films were dead,
right?
And and I think that played a little part in it. You know, I think the myopic views of Universal, they just could not see, they could not convince him, and God bless him for sticking to his guns, but they could not convince him to do it CGI. And I did some tests for him in CGI. We did a CGI Hero Bear. We tried cel shading. We tried anything to try to help him come around to it, but just
wouldn't work out.
Yeah.
I think, am I incorrect in thinking, I'm trying to think back, that Curious George release, that was put in CGI, right? That was in...
No, I think it was 2D.
Was it? Okay. I didn't even...
I don't know. I mean, you know, it wasn't CGI. It wasn't okay. CGI. I remember, God, was this the one with Will Ferrell?
You know, I didn't even watch it.
I think it was 2D, and I don't think it did very well. I don't know, but I just remember the Jack Johnson song.
Yeah, that's right. You know? That's right. Yeah, so it was not. Yeah, you're right. It was not CGI. I was just so angry. I refused to go see it because, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah. Anyway. So, all right. Well, let's move on to 2008, and you're sitting down, presumably at the, as the story goes, with your kids and at the table, and suddenly out of a bag of animal crackers, boom, here comes the movie, Animal Crackers, right? No, that wasn't that easy, was it? But so how did that come about, really?
It was in the backyard, not the table. So, okay. You know, set your facts straight there. But no, but yeah, we were in the backyard just playing and eating those Barnum's animal crackers. And you're just fooling around with the kids. You're like, well, what if when you eat a lion cookie, poof, you turn into a lion? And so, of course, you know, they eat a lion cookie and they're like, ah, you know, what if when you eat a giraffe cookie, you turn into a giraffe? And what do you do? And so that was it. And so I kind of just thought, oh, that's kind of cute. And so I started writing a children's book, a graphic novel. I had a deal with IDW at the time, and they were publishing all my kids' books. So I think they published like 8 or 9 of them at the time. And so I had written it down, and it was, you know, I thought, well, where's a fun place to do something like this? And I came up with the idea for a circus and the clowns and everything else. And so I wrote it as a kid's graphic novel. We illustrated it, and then the IDW didn't pay me the money for the past 9 books. So we kind of terminated our agreement. So the book never came out. So what we did was it just kind of sat there, and it was years later that, I was in a meeting, with someone from Hollywood, and they said, well, do you have anything with, you know, we could do like a live action with CGI animals along the lines of Alvin and the Chipmunks. And so I was like, oh, I've got this book, and I showed him the comic book, and you know, the it was like a PDF of it because it wasn't published. And oh, this is great. Can you turn it into a screenplay? I was like, oh, okay. I've never written a screenplay before, you know? So yeah. My buddy, Kevin Grievous, who had written Underworld, he's like, you should write the screenplay. And because I was trying to get him to help me out. And he's like, no, I write werewolves and vampire stuff. You know, I'll write Frankenstein, but I'm not going to write a kid's animated thing. He's like, you could do it. And I was like, I've never written a screenplay before I went to art school. He goes, dude, I was a microbiologist when I wrote Underworld. He goes, you don't need a degree in it. You can just write it. So he really kind of just convinced me. He's like, you've written all these books. He goes, you can write a screenplay. And so I wrote the screenplay. And fortunately, Dean Laurie, I had met him. Dean Laurie wrote Arrested Development. He wrote Major Pain. He wrote My Wife and Kids. Tons of you know, great stuff. I had met him at a meeting, and you know, I just kind of called him up and said, hey, I'm writing my first screenplay. You know, I have to turn it into these people. Not that I was getting paid, but it was just like, you know, can you take a look at it? And he's like, sure. So he would look over my writing and give me notes, and you know, really kind of just helped me, just gave me tips, you know, mm-hmm. kind of point me in the right direction. And so by the time I finished the script, I handed it to him. It was like a few months later. They're like, oh, we're not looking for that anymore. We've moved on to something else. You know, it's like just the short attention span of a Hollywood producer. And so I had a screenplay. So there we go. I had a screenplay. And then a couple of years later, I met a guy here in Franklin, Tennessee, whose brother was the CFO of the Weinstein Company. And he was like, I think I could sell this to Harvey. And so he sent over the script, and Harvey didn't read the script. They have this thing called coverage, which is like a book report that someone does for, you know, the head of the company. So he doesn't have to read a script. And so it kind of, they check off, you know, how are the characters? How is it, what's the plot like? Is it this? Is it that? And it does a little, like a little summary. So he could read that. It's like a one page summary, and it checks off all the things. And I got, you know, I got a good book report. You know, they really liked the script. And then I got the offer, which was, you know, a typical Harvey Weinstein offer. I get to own everything, you know, which I was like, no, you know, this is my movie. And so, that's when it kind of, we went off to go and see if we can make the movie ourselves. And that leads into the rest of the story, if you want me to go on.
Yeah. So now I did, there was an article, I believe, in the Tennessean. It was a nice write-up, that featured you and your wife and everything, and talking about animal crackers. And I wanted to touch on something kind of related, well, definitely related to that. And that is, I know a lot of the listeners are young folks starting out, young artists starting out, that, you know, of course, a lot of them, we all hit obstacles along the way, and you're trying to pursue your passion and your dream and stuff. And I think there's a lot of sense of, oh, you know, you get a movie out, like, oh, there was nothing to it. It was a straight path from, you know, A to B. No. And I know that's not true, but even looking at that article, you guys went through some serious challenges. I mean, not just creatively. I mean, you went through some stuff like financially and I'm sure emotionally, as you've, like, you already were talking about a few of them. You know, where it's kind of a letdown a little bit here, a little bit there. I was wondering if you could just touch on some of those other without, I mean, I don't want to dig into your private stuff, but I mean,
there's nothing private about my life. Don't worry about it. It's just life. It really is. It's just life. And you know, you can live a safe life, with a safe job, doing, you know, the same thing and avoid a lot of the drama. Or you could take some chances. And if you do take chances, you could get very hurt. You could, you know, it's not like we were going for fortune and glory. A little bit of fortune would have been nice, but, you know, but the thing is that it was just, if we're going to make a movie, why should someone like a Harvey Weinstein own it? Why can't we do it? And so, you know, we struggled when IDW didn't come through with the money that they owed us. You know, we had invested, we put all of the costs for all of the artwork and everything to making those 9 or 10 books. We had toys, we had everything. We had put all that on credit cards. Mm-hmm. And they owed us a couple $100,000 and they didn't pay us. So suddenly bankruptcy, you know, we didn't go bankruptcy, but we were facing bankruptcy. We were facing foreclosure on our house. Our car got repoed. It was just, you know, really bad. And we was like, what are we going to do? And, wow. You know, I was 40 something years old and, you know, how am I going to, it's 2000. I think it was around 2009, 2010. So yeah. So I was like maybe 41 years old. How are we going to pay for this? How am I going to get a job? I haven't worked in, you know, the industry in a while. I've been writing these books for the last 6 or 7 years. And so my wife, she said, well, let's see if we can get a movie going. You wrote the script and let's see what we can do. And so she took a job at Target, you know, and I took care of the kids and I was writing and I was networking and whatever else I could do. It took 2, maybe 3 years. She, you know, she got a temp job and she wound up, you know, essentially just being a secretary, but enough to put food on our plates and enough to keep the house from going into foreclosure. And we just lived with one car that, you know, we had that was paid off, the minivan, and we just survived. We were on food stamps for a while. And then when we were able to get off that, we did, but it was just life. It wasn't easy. It was stressful. It was, you know, and you think about all the stuff that I had done, you think about all the video games and this and that and Spider-Man and you think, you know, we had optioned, we did, you know, Emperor, we did this, you know, we had optioned Pet Robots to Disney. We had optioned Hyperactive to, MTV and The Luckiest Boy was picked up by Fox and none of that stuff was going on. We thought, you know, because you know, when someone like Disney calls and say, hey, we want to turn this into a movie, and they hired Colin Trevorrow, who wound up writing one of the Star Wars movies, he directed and wrote the Lost World movies, you know, and this is before he did those, but they hired a good writer to come in and write a script, and it just never got into production. And you think, you know, God, this is gonna be, because if it goes into production, we get, you know, like a couple $100,000, which would set everything right.
Right.
And we had, you know, I think we did option stuff like 3 or 4 times and none of it happened. And so, you know, you get these, hey, you know, you're going to be okay. And then it doesn't happen. So we were disappointed, but nothing's a given in life. And we just have to be okay with it. So anyways, yeah, we somehow just eventually, we got our first $1 million from a Korean investor. And this was through, when I say it was a friend of a friend of a friend, it was our friend Harry Mock, who we had met when I worked at Atari, 28 years ago. He was at a meeting who met a guy from Australia who knew a guy who knew a guy who knew two guys who knew some people in China who did, I mean, there was like 15, 16 people between me and the investor. And every single one of them wanted, you know, had their hand out to get, you know, a piece of the pie or a credit or something like that. But we got $1 million. And once we had $1 million, it was like, oh my God, we're actually going to do it. Now, it wasn't our $1 million, but it was for them to make the movie. And then we got another $13 million from China. And then we got another $5 million from a fisherman in Seattle. We made a movie. We were at our lowest lows. We couldn't. I remember I had to go out to Spain to go, you know, look at the studio. I didn't have any money. I didn't have any nice clothes. I didn't, you know, like I was just, right. You know, we were on food stamps, and I had to call my family who had already been lending us money. They'd lent us money to survive. I mean, you know, when you know, you're calling cousins and aunts, or even our next door neighbor lent us $15,000.
Oh my goodness.
So we could survive for another few more months, you know. It was just we were desperate. We were just asking everybody, you know, it's like, look, you know, if we could just have a little more time. And so they lent me money so I could fly out to Spain, and then when we got back, and then I had to go out to Los Angeles to go sign a deal with, because the Chinese wanted me to fly to China. I was like, I just can't do it.
So gosh.
They kind of met us halfway in Los Angeles, and so we flew from Nashville to Los Angeles, and we signed the deal, and then suddenly we went from food stamps to we have $13-14 million in the bank account, and we're making a movie. It was just. It was insane, and it took a while for it to sink in, because you keep thinking you're gonna wake up, and it was just a dream, so it took a while for it to become the norm, and you know, the first thing you do when you get a check like that is you go and you buy socks and underwear for your kids, because you know they had soles in their socks, and come on, let's go get you new shoes and stuff, and that's it, and. The sad part is that, you know, the $19 million that we got, we didn't, you know, my wife got a salary of $45,000 a year. I got $150,000 for my screenplay. The $150,000 paid back all of the credit card debts, all of the family that, you know, lent us money over the years and whatnot, and got us to zero. And then we lived on the $45,000 a year. For three years or so. And so it's not like we became rich or anything,
right?
But the experience was amazing. You know, we made a movie, we were traveling. We took the whole family that summer to Spain, to go, you know, meet the studio. And we stopped off in London and we went to Paris and we took a train out, you know, and we just, 'cause for 4 years, every summer was a staycation. Sorry, kids, we can't do anything. And so we're like, you know what? Donna and I, we have to go out for business. The kids were 2014, they were 11. And so we're like, you know what? We're going to take you guys to Spain. And it's not like the kids, I'm telling you, 11-year-olds don't want to go to Spain.
Right.
And we want to go to Disneyland, you know? Right. So, but we, you know, we got to do that. And, so that was, a wonderful time to just kind of go and just, you know, we spent 2 weeks, you know, working, you know, doing that. And, but it was really, really wonderful. And, so I think there's the ups and downs. It's just life, and there's nothing is guaranteed. And we could have never gotten that money, and we could still be struggling. But you know, sometimes some good stuff happens, and sometimes bad stuff happens. There's really not much you could do about it, but just, you know, make the best of it.
Yeah, well, that's thanks for sharing, because that is such an inspirational story. It's amazing, and furthermore, you hear about artists, you know, going through some stuff, but it's like, you are already, like, you had a family. That's hard. It's one thing if you're by yourself, right? It's just affecting you, but this was affecting, I mean, it also underscores the importance of support, family support, and you obviously had it. And that's fantastic. And that is so important.
And my family is not rich. they were, you know, my cousins, you know, were lending me their kids' college fund. Here's $25,000. They were taking second mortgages out of their houses. You know, my parents were lending me, you know, whatever little money they had tucked away, you know. So it was, you know, it wasn't like, you know, we had rich uncles or somebody we could go to.
Right.
And then, of course, there was the fact that my wife, she went and was at 5 a.m. unloading boxes, you know, off the truck at the docks at Target, you know, for a few months until she got a temp job and then moved her way up and whatnot. But she was supporting the family. And she's like, you know, first of all, no one wants to hire me because I'm an artist. I have no skills whatsoever that anybody, even Target, doesn't want to hire me, you know. So she was a marketing major. She can speak this, you know, she can talk the talk. She can do that stuff. She's very hireable. And I just never had, you know, since the video game days at Atari, I haven't had a full-time job. It's always been freelance. And so I don't have a resume, you know. It's like, where's the last place you worked? Well, that was 25 years ago, you know. But so she went and she supported us. And she did that for 3 years to make that happen. Having a partner who believes in you, having somebody who believes in this. And it wasn't without her. Oh my God, we're letting our kids down. We're horrible parents. You know, that was a conversation we had every day.
Right.
You know, but, I think the hardest thing was I had most of my family was saying, Scott, you had a good run, but I think it's time to give up being an artist. Could you imagine being told that at 40? You know, I've been an artist my whole life. I don't have any other skills. Right. You're going to have to go work at FedEx. Go be a delivery. Go do this. Go do that. Go get a job. You know, you're the husband. Go. Why is your wife working? You know, she should be. You know, yeah, that kind of thing. And it's like, but that's not the relationship that, you know, my wife and I have.
Right.
She's a very strong person. She's very capable, and she's like, I got this. I got this. I believe in what you're doing and what we'll be doing together. And that's why she, you know, when time came, she never made a movie any more than I'd ever made a movie. And I said, here's $19 million. Don't screw it up. <You know? laughs> And so she was in charge. She wrote all of the checks. She handled all of the contracts with Sylvester Stallone and, you know, and everybody. That was her. She managed all of that stuff because she earned that, you know,
so valuable. That's incredible. Yeah. That, on that note too, I will say right off the bat, I want to, you know, make sure I tell you that it's such a beautiful movie. It really is. Every facet of, you know, of the movie itself it's phenomenal. I mean, I loved it.
Oh, thank you.
And I'll be honest too. I guess the early 2000s, whatever. I wasn't a huge CGI movie fan, only because there was a point where that I felt like a lot of the characters all looked the same.
Yeah.
And then there was the issue of, let's just show off the technology, but let's, you know, there's so much for the story, whatever. We're not worried about the story. Let's just show. And little by little though, I think as that industry matured, as that technology matured, I think you started to get story writers behind it, said, okay, we know what it can do. We know what it can look like, but now let's start to really put some story into these things, you know? And, so here comes Animal Crackers, and a friend of mine out of Macon, Georgia, who's a huge fan of yours. And he had said, you know, have you heard about Animal Crackers? And I said, I've heard about it. And he said, well, you get Animation Magazine? Because I told him I did, and at one point, whatever. And I looked, wait a minute, there's an article about Scott in here. Let me look. And then I told my wife, I said, we got to check this out. And she's like, but I thought you didn't like CGI. I'm like, yeah, let's check it out. You know, so, you know, we're sitting back watching it. And I'm telling you, from the moment it started, from beginning to end, I love the backgrounds. I love, you know, I look at all the details, too. It was just, I was captivated, you know, and then,
thank you.
And I don't know who was behind all the voice casting, and,
I will happily tell you everybody, cause everybody deserves credit.
Yeah.
You know? As you know, I had a script and then the great thing was when we got the money, I was able to call Dean Laurie. You know, who was helping me, the writer who was, you know, had written Arrested Development. He was the one who, on his way to work every, you know, once a week, he would call me and give me notes, give me advice. So I was able to say, Dean, I did it. I got money. I can pay you. You know, so he got money for helping me out. And then he came in and we had sessions together and so the script really, really grew. There, I was able to bring in Tony Bancroft, who was the director of Mulan.
Oh yeah,
and he was able to come in and help out as a co-director of the film. We got Carter Goodrich, who designed Finding Nemo, Brave, Monsters Inc., Ratatouille, Despicable Me, The Croods, Coco. I mean, you know, he's this wonderful illustrator, and his designs are so unique, which gives our character such a unique look. We brought in Armand Serrano, who had done the backgrounds for Zootopia and Big Hero 6 and Moana. So we were able to bring in all of these really talented artists and writers who were able to then polish my humble, you know, meager story and everything else. And so it really had so many people who were accomplished, who came on and they liked the story that I had written. They liked this story. They're like, it was, you know, apparently as if, you know, as the book report for Harvey Weinstein said, it was a good story. So that was good. And then I had a friend of mine, Jamie Thomason, who I had met on Emperor, the casting director, and we just stayed friends. And he'd always said, if you ever get money, I can get you a good cast. And so I got to call him and say, I got money. And so he said, great. And the casting was, it's such a weird experience because I only had two voices in my head when I wrote the script. It was Ian McKellen as Horatio P. Huntington. Ian McKellen plays Gandalf in Magneto. And Patrick Warburton, who's Putty from Seinfeld. I had him for Brock. And that was it. I didn't have any other voices in my head but those two. So when he asked, I was like, those were the two voices. He's like, I can get Patrick. I'm a friend, you know, we're friends, we're close. Patrick's the lock. I was like, cool. He's like, Ian McKellen, for your first movie, for you know, the budget that you have. He goes like, I don't think so. So he said, but he says, we can always ask. He says, but if we're gonna ask, we might as well ask a couple other, you know, big names and see what happens. So we sent offers out to, he's like, you know, what do you think about, you know, who, what other actors do you like? I was like, well, I like, you know, Sylvester Stallone and Danny DeVito. So we sent out offers to that. And who do you think for Binkley? I thought Raven Simone. And well, nothing. No one was getting back to us. Everybody was too busy to read the script, this and that, whatever. So weeks and weeks and weeks are going by and I'm going crazy. And he's like, look, it's not that the actors don't want to do it. It's just, to be perfectly honest, you're nobody. And the agents aren't really putting you at the top of the list. They've got many other big $100 million films that they're working on. This little tiny film is not really going to get a lot of attention. Well, we got a call one day. Ian McKellen signed on. He's like, I'm in. And I was like, oh my God, Ian Gandalf's in my film? Yes. The next day, all of the other agents heard that Ian McKellen had signed. Oh my God, Ian McKellen signed on to this little film? It must be something. And next day, Sylvester Stallone, Danny DeVito, Raven Simone all signed on. We had, you know, and so it was really cool. So we didn't have the, you know, Owen and Zoe. They were not cast. And Jamie, he says, I'm going to throw a name out at you. Well, originally Justin Timberlake, one of the agents also repped Justin Timberlake and said, what about Justin Timberlake? Justin Timberlake's cool. And they're like, great. He wants this much money. I was like, well, that was like twice what we were paying everybody else. We just didn't have the budget. So it didn't work out. So, okay, we can't do Justin Timberlake. And then we were going to work with Neil Patrick Harris. But then Neil Patrick Harris got the gig to host the Oscars. And so he was like, he wasn't able to do it. And so it was a little bit of that, you know, it was just stuff that is typical in Hollywood. So yeah. I was like, we got to start production. So he's like, well, I'm going to throw a name out at you. John Krasinski. I go, never heard of the guy. And and he's like, he's in that TV show, The Office. Like, I never saw it. And it was 2014. So John Krasinski was not a household name.
Right.
And
right.
I just had never seen The Office. And he's like, well, trust me, he's really funny. I was like, I trust you. You know, you're amazing, Jamie. I trust you. So I flew out for the first session. It was John Krasinski and then Danny DeVito and Raven Simone. And
wow.
So I flew out from Nashville and I'm sitting there with John Krasinski, and I meet him, and he's just the nicest guy, and he starts the first lines, and I was like, oh my God, that's Owen. Like, I didn't know what he was going to sound like until John said it, and then I was like, that's Owen. There was just that charm, that sense of humor and that charm that John just has that was perfect. And I was like, oh my God, this is perfect. So 4 hours of that, and I was sending videos to my wife and to everybody in Spain, and I was like, oh my God, look at this. This is Owen. You know, this is so Owen. Cool.
Yeah,
we got Owen. So afterwards, the session's over, and I go in. I was like, oh my God, that was the coolest thing, because it's my first session of anything ever. So it was just the coolest thing. So he's like, you know, he goes, hey, you know, it's my pleasure. He goes, it's a lot of fun. He goes, I love the script. He goes, you know, my wife just thought the script was adorable. And, you know, she just used such a great script and such a good concept and blah, blah, blah. Now, I didn't know who he was married to.
Right.
I didn't know who he was. So I was just like, oh, thank you. And I walked away. Well, fortunately, the mics were hot. So everybody, Tony, Jamie, everybody comes running in. They're like, would your wife want to be in the movie? And so he's like, yeah, sure. So he picks up his phone. He's like, hey, babe, you want to be in Animal Crackers? And like 5 minutes later, she responds. She's like, sure. And that's how Emily Blunt came on the film. It was
that's so ridiculous.
Oh, it was crazy. Yeah, it was just crazy. But yeah, we the whole thing was amazing. I flew out to London to go meet Ian McKellen, and New York to work with Harvey Fierstein and Wallace Shawn and Gilbert Gottfried, and everybody was just so nice. And welcoming, and I mean, Danny DeVito, I always think of a curmudgeon. I always think of something like The Lorax and I just was nervous, and he came in and he was just so happy and so joyful. Like, he was that, 'cause I wanted the clown to be just, you know, not scary, you know.
Right.
And so,
right.
He was so funny. He was so nice, and he was just, and it was so complimentary and everything like that. That it was just like everything just kind of fit into place. It was really, really fun. And
and his voice worked out so great for that, for Chesterfield, for the clown. I'm like, that's
it.
Incredible.
Really did. Yeah. He kept doing, you know. He was just, yeah, you know, he was like, and he was so we just put that in, and the same thing with John and Emily. John and Emily. John makes Emily laugh all the time. Just their relationship. He's just so funny. She's cracking up. And so we just kept that in. So you'll just see, like, you know, the beginning when he's like, you know, your dad has me eating dog biscuits. Stop and think about that for a minute. You know, your dad has me, and she's just laughing. So we just kept it in. So like a whole bunch of times she's laughing. And they ad-libbed, I would say, at least half of their lines. Like half of that stuff I didn't write. They were just making stuff up. It was so funny. That was their first movie together, and they were just having a blast. Well, and so it was just a great experience.
That's cool that you left that in too, because that, I don't know, to me the continuity is wonderful. I mean, it's just, and that may be a part of it. The flow is just great. The dialogue, the interaction between the characters, and Brock. I mean, as soon as I heard that voice, I'm like, oh my God, you know.
he's so funny.
Yeah.
He really is. Yeah. He, you know, but see, like he came up with the whole gag of, you know, just the breathing. He was like, is this too close for you? You know, and he was just, I think it was in response to Jamie saying, you know, hey, we're picking up, you know, too much. Why don't you back away from the mic, Patrick? And so Patrick was teasing Jamie, but it was so funny because we were all laughing. I was like, we should get John to react to that. And so then it was like, next time we saw John, we had him react to Patrick's recording. And he's like, it's a little too close. You know, your breath's not so good, that kind of stuff. So it was just, there was so much spontaneity that we let it kind of sit in there. And then the other thing we did that I don't think any other movies do is, we took the audio, Jamie and I took the audio, and we made a radio play of it. So we edited all of the dialogue and everything together as a radio play before we put pictures to it, just so we could say, if it's funny without pictures, it'll be funnier once it has picture. And wow. So we kind of did it as a radio play to just listen to it. And we really, I wanted the dialogue to be really kind of overlapping, because that's how I talk with my wife. You know, I have a short attention span. So if you're in the middle of a conversation, you're saying something and I have an idea, I've got to say it. Otherwise I'm going to forget it. So yeah. I'll jump in, you know, kind of thing. And so I kind of wanted, it's kind of like a Gilmore Girls kind of thing. We're just talking fast and talking over each other. And so we kind of did that. And I think it just really just works well. And John and Emily are so genuinely in love and so wonderful together that it reminded me of me and my wife. And so originally, Owen was the one who was fighting Horatio at the end. Owen was the one who saves the circus. And it, when I saw that relationship, it reminded me of what my wife had done to get us there. And I was like, this has got to be, it's got to be equal. It's got to be a 50-50 thing. And so I changed the story to where Zoe leaves the company and she goes to save the, you know, to save the circus. And Owen's afraid to, because he feels that he's got to be that responsible one. And so yeah. Zoe takes that chance. And at the end, Zoe and Mackenzie help save the circus from Horatio. So it's more of, I think it was more realistic. And, yeah. And I think it reflected John and Emily, and it reflected me and my wife a little more.
Well, that's it. Yeah. That's phenomenal. Okay, so going back to like when it was actually just the movie was starting out, and then here comes this little song, "While We Were Young," so it immediately gets my attention, you know. And I said, "Oh, that sounds just like Huey Lewis in the News. It's got to be, you know." And so I'm listening to it, and then of course, you know, the movie goes on, and then it's over. So then I'm walking around the kitchen, just humming that song, playing in my head, and just it's over and over. I can't shake it. I'm like going that. It's such a simple tune. And my wife's like going, enough, you know, just like, and I'm like, I can't. So I said, all right, I got to find this song and just download it and get it out of my system. And of course, a week later, it's still in my system. I'm like, okay, I got to ask him how that came about. How did he get connected with Huey Lewis, first of all? God. And then secondly, that song, was it something that he already, you know, I wasn't a diehard Huey Lewis fan. Some of his stuff, of course, resonates because growing up, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
So how did all that come about? I mean, with that one song.
Well, I for our music supervisor, I met Andy Ross. Andy Ross had just done the movie Whiplash, which was a jazz musician movie, and so he's like, give me a list of, you know, music that you like, and I'll see if I can find it for you. Well, it was all 80s music, you know, 80s and 90s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. You know, he's like, okay, you know, so at the top of the list was Huey Lewis. I was like, I want to have a Huey Lewis song in there. You know, I just, it has that Americana vibe that I was going for, you know? And so I swear within a week he had me on a phone call with Huey Lewis. I'm like on a phone call with Huey freaking Lewis. Right. And he's, sounds exactly like you know, you hear him, and he's just I read your script. It's so good, Scott. You know, he's just, this. And my wife is bumping into me because she's following me everywhere because I'm pacing, right? She's like trying to hear his voice. And so I had to stop and say, excuse me, Huey, can you do me a favor and say hi to my wife? Because I can't have this conversation with her hanging over me this whole time. So he's like, hi, Donna. Hi, so nice to meet you. She's like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm talking to Huey Lewis, you know? So she was just freaking out. And I would say probably with, well, okay, I'm jumping ahead. So he's like, I've got a couple songs that I've written. Cause he's like, I don't write songs to demand. He's like, if you look at The Power of Love, goes, has nothing to do with Back to the Future. He's like, you know, he's like, it was a song we had written, and you know, and Robert Zemeckis and Steven Spielberg, they're like, we like it, we'll take it. And that was the name of the song for the movie, you know. So he's like, I've got a song, he goes, I think is really good, and you know, let me send it to you. So he sent us this song, which was While We're Young. Mm-hmm. And we're listening to it, we're like, this is a good song. But in my mind, I was thinking of The Power of Love. I wanted a powerful, upbeat song that was going to be like, here's the movie,
right?
Not a ballad, you know, kind of a chill while we're young, you know. I was thinking, that's The Power of Love. That's what I was thinking. And so I can't believe I said this, but I sent an email to Huey Lewis saying, this is great, but it's not really what we're looking for,
you know? Oh, my God.
And here's the thing. And Huey's like, no problem. The next day, my wife was still humming the song. Just like you were, it's like we couldn't get it out of our head. Like, oh my God, we can't get this. So I emailed him. I was like, oh my God, we can't get this. We're gonna find a place for this song. And because it was like, we love the song. We can't stop listening to it. We can't stop humming it. We love the song. You're right. It's a great song. And he's like, I figured you'd come around. So he was just so cool about it. And I think it was maybe a month or two later, he was doing, you know, a concert tour, and he was going to be in Nashville. So he's like, hey, let's get together for lunch. I'm like, oh my God, Huey Lewis wants to get together with us for lunch. So a couple Xanax later, and my wife were, sitting down with Huey Lewis for lunch. And amazing. He was just the nicest guy. And so we found that spot, you know, because it was, you know, the story at the time was there. I was looking for a Power of Love type of opening. We were going to do like a credit kind of, you know, thing. And
right.
And so, you know, we just kind of changed it up and said, okay, we'll put this here, and that'll work a little better.
Well, it was great. It fit. It was, yeah. So I just kept playing that song over and over. I'm like,
have you seen the music video we did?
No.
Look up the While We're Young music video. I told you my first job when I was a junior in college was at Sega of America doing 16-bit video games.
Yeah.
Well, my son and I, we did two music videos. We did one for Toe the Wet Sprocket, which we did all in Muppets. And then we did one for Huey Lewis, which we did to make it look like a 16-bit video game. We kind of had like a side scrolling where he's walking through his life. It's pretty cool. I like it. And there's a bunch of little Easter eggs in there and whatnot, but take a look at it when you can.
You know, I will. That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, I know I had spent time. It really flew here. I've had a great, great time. Hopefully, you've enjoyed it as well.
But
I want to throw one last silly question here. So if we were to ask your wife, or your kids, really, if what animal you are, if you were to eat a cracker, what you would be, what would they say, and versus what you would want to be if you were to chew on an animal cracker and have your animal of choice?
My wife would probably say an
oh, jeez.
Oh, God. Jokingly, she probably would, knowing her. My kids, God, I don't know. Maybe something like a mole or something that just hides out underground because I just like to hang out in my hobbit hole. If I had my choice, I would always say a cheetah because cheetahs were always my favorite, the fastest land animal. I always liked them. So
that's cool.
That would be my choice.
Excellent. Very cool. Well, you know, again, there's so much more we could talk to you. I'm going to talk about with your career, but I'm very thankful that you were able to give me the time that you did. I mean, I've already gone over what I've promised I would take of your time. So,
it's fine. I really had a good time. I really had a good. You're a wonderful person to talk to. I really do appreciate it.
Well, that's great. I think you're only about. Let's see, you're just a few hours away from me. I'm in Memphis, so it's...
Oh, really?
Yeah, I've got a buddy that lives in Franklin.
Yeah, that's where I'm at.
Up there, yeah. He moved from here, like, last year. And so and they got their place all set up. And we're like, okay, yeah, we're going to go up there. And then, of course, COVID hits. And like, whoops, so much for that. So,
so much for that, yeah.
Yeah. But, no, I really do appreciate it. And I'm going to... I can't wait to check out that video as well. So now if anyone were to want to follow you online that they don't know already, which I'm sure most people do know where to find you, but if not, where would you want to have them go?
I've been posting the most to TikTok. That's been at least since August. I joined in August, and it's where I'm posting a lot of content. So it's Ssava Art, Ssava Art. Okay. And the same thing, Ssava Art, I think, is also my Instagram. And
yeah,
then
and that's
where
I think I caught up with you there. I went over there on Instagram. I hadn't done the TikTok thing yet, but
TikTok is amazing. I've been on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and YouTube and everything else 15 years or wherever it is. And I got more followers on TikTok in the first month than all of that. I'm at like closing in on 40,000 followers now. And the people there are so encouraging, and they're just hungry for content. And I think it's just because everything is knocked down to about a minute, but also it's just videos. And people just, you know, they've been very, very nice. It's been a wonderful community for art, at least. And so that's been encouraging me. That's why I've been doing 2 or 3 paintings a day, is because of TikTok. It's been great to get me through COVID too.
Yeah.
So that's been good. So yeah, that's where, if you want to see the most of my stuff, you know, that's really where it is.
Excellent. Excellent. You got anything coming down the pike that you can share, or is it a lot of stuff under wraps that you really can't share?
We are hoping we can announce a sequel to Animal Crackers. I wasn't planning on doing a sequel, but Nabisco got wind of the movie, and now they want to know if I can, you know, do a sequel. And so we've been talking to them. And
wow.
But I've also got, you know, Pet Robots and Edge Terrestrials. My grandparents are secret agents, and my other stuff. So we're trying to get the next movie up and running. And we're hoping it's going to be a little easier than the first time. but you know, just this last year has just been crazy, and so, you know, the plus side is the movie was the number one animated movie of the summer in the world, and the downside is no one knows about it because Netflix doesn't release that information, you know. So it's really hard to convince people that, you know, hey, the movie did really well, you know, Netflix said so. Well, can you get them to tell me? No, they don't release that information, you know. But it did really well, and so we're hoping we can make another movie. I think this time I know to pay myself first. So that's what I promised my wife, is we're gonna pay ourselves up front.
And, there you go. Well, excellent. I look forward to that. That would be fantastic to see that.
Yeah.
So anyway, well, Scott, really, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for sacrificing some time here out of your day.
My pleasure, Todd, really. Yeah. I had a great time, and I look forward to the next time we do it.
Well, this wraps up my interview with Scott, and I'm almost certain that at some point there will be a sequel, and probably in the near future, as he enters new phases of his already wonderful career. I, for one, can't wait. I certainly enjoyed this interview, and I am very, very appreciative of you joining me. And hopefully you will return next month for the next What's Your Story podcast, coming out in February. Thanks, and have a great rest of the month. Stay safe.
What's Your Story is recorded live at Togo Tune Studios in Memphis, Tennessee.
Say they were just right for harvesting, wouldn't you?
I would indeed. Indeed, I would.
Well, come on. Let's go harvesting.
After you.
Oh, no. You first.
Thank you.